When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.
Now is the best time to start working at Amazon. They are offering sign-on bonuses up to $3,000 and hourly pay up to $22 per hour. You'll bring home a great weekly paycheck, and many jobs come with benefits that start on your first day. That's higher pay, sign-on bonuses, benefits day one. And you'll be part of a safe and inclusive workplace ranked among the best in the world. Go to amazon.com/apply to start your job search today. Amazon is proud to be an equal opportunity employer.
Welcome back to the Cosmology and Science Podcast. My name is Richard and I am your host today. And in this episode, we are going to talk about Stephen Meyer's books, especially the first book and the third book. So we made a review of the second book and now we've gone through the first one, The Signature of the Cell, which is a really, really good book. It's kind of heavy on the science part. And we started with a couple of hundred pages into his third book, which is the new one, The Return of the God Hypothesis, that is out this month. And we're going to go through both of them and then have some reflections and thoughts on this. So overall, going into the details of the cells, this is maybe the most important thing for this episode, is that it is kind of stunning to see the complexity of the nanomachinery in the cells. It is a hyper-sophisticated nanomachine, a digital information processing system with molecules. And it's also, in some ways, it's kind of beyond what we are able to create ourselves yet. And there's also still many open questions about the code that is in the DNA, what it means. There's so many layers to it. Parts of the DNA is kind of little streams of codes that are defining or the recipe to make proteins. But there's also lots of other things that we don't understand yet what it is, what it says. Gradually, the last 10 to 15 years in genomics, like there's been this, all these discoveries that you could also, in some ways, look at it. A part of it is like looking at a hard drive that you have information spread out all over the disk. So this is the same with the gene, this kind of the long streams of the base pairs that sometimes it's kind of they take bits, kind of chunks of code from many different places and put them together. And then that becomes a message or an instruction set. And there's also like one string can also mean many different things, up to like thousands of different things, because you can take one stream. This is like coding messages in with like spies and like wartime things. Like you have a message, but then you have a key, then you can transpose the message into you do little calculations on all the little letters, for example, and if you have a coded message, and then you get another message that means something else. And this is also the same then. One has discovered over the last 10 to 15 years with the gene sequencing, and also that there's a system of kind of levels in in the genes that they are kind of arranged into folders and then super folders and then mega folders. Like the instructions for a small thing, in kind of, let's say like a hand or like some part of the body, kind of you have arranged them into sections. And this is just an emerging field of science that is full of new discoveries all the time. So these things are just stunning, because it is like we have only recently, within let's say the 100 last years, discovered computer science. And now we see that so many of the things we have been trying to develop has been implemented at the molecule atom level in the cells, which which have been around for 3 billion years. So that's part of the argument in his first book. So back like to Stephen Meyer and the way he presents this, his writing is crystal clear. It's the, you can take just the science bit, like when he's presenting the topics, and just learn about the cells. And then you get the reflections on and the mysteries as he sees it. And you can choose to relate to that or not in some ways. Just to kind of to present the book, he makes the argument that there is just this basic comparison when you find something very complicated that you could ask, like, is this, whether it looks, which of two alternatives is most likely, that it just appeared randomly, or that it is, does it look more like a designed process or like a complete kind of out of randomness, which is one of the strongest arguments might be the problem with creating a self-replicating cell. Because if you have, at some point you need, if a cell, like the first cells, let's say 3.5 billion years ago, if they don't self-replicate, they just disappear. So you need, from kind of out of nothing, you need to suddenly have the level where you have a little machinery that can replicate itself, or kind of self-breed, if you like. And the jump from chemistry floating around to a self-replicating machine is an area of research. It seems like you need something like 300 genes is one estimate. It's the minimum amount of genes to have enough descriptions and kind of definitions and a system to self-replicate. And to get that from nothing is still one of those mysteries, that first little step. So that's, in some ways, one could say one of the strongest arguments of the book is just looking at the technology, the system, and then wonder how you get there. So that is in some ways the gist of the first book. And then the second book, we talked about it in the last episode, so that's more focused on the Cambrian explosion, kind of how we get from one-celled animals and sponges to this huge variety of animals roughly around 500 million years ago, with the trilobites, and then this, like, all different kinds of animals that are super sophisticated compared to the sponges, which are kind of five different cells or just one-celled animals, and then how this jump happened. So, but that is more, you have more likely hypotheses about kind of how this could have evolved. When it's sometimes with a creative process, once it starts, it kind of erupts sometimes, because there's something about, for example, breaking some boundaries, and then suddenly you can have this extreme variety suddenly happening before things kind of define their shapes, and then you suddenly have new body plans, for example. So, and then quickly jumping to the new book. So the first two books, they came out in 2009 and 2013. And the new book is out now then in 2021, March, April. And it's a little bit different reading. So the first two books are really great. You can read it for the science and be amazed by it in itself. A little bit of the issue we have here with the third book is that he's bringing out the third part with cosmology. And there are some problematic parts about how he describes the cosmology, especially how he promotes the Big Bang theory as kind of fully settled and sorted. And there are still some big issues with that theory that is not presented in the book. So as we talked about in other episodes earlier here, and we have the interviews with, for example, Chris Brown, who's more like an independent physicist or cosmologist. But you can just look at the basis, like that theory. We're going to make this really short, but that theory is the sole premise is the redshift of distant galaxies, and that could come from different sources. And there are some problems with that. That redshift, seemingly, if that is interpreted as something moving away, it's equally in all directions from the Earth. And then the postulate is still that the Earth is not the center of the universe, but that there is no center of the cosmos. But that does not make any sense. If you start with a flash, a point, and it grows, it will have a shape. And if you have a shape, there will be some part, there will be a center and a periphery of a shape. So that in itself is just seen as something that is hard to explain. And you could have these theories about like the something, like the shifting of the light could be affected by the distance. And that would also just explain why it looks like everything, the further away it is, it seems, well, it shifts more and it shifts equal in all directions from the viewpoint of the observer. So anyways, that's just one of them. And you also have things like the age of the universe. If you calculate the way that theory does, it doesn't. There is a star 200 light years away from us that is about 14 billion years old. It was first thought to be 16 billion years old, and the universe is supposed to be 13.7. And then they have found different way of estimating the age and kind of brought it down to 14. And then they think, well, soon we will find another more accurate way, and then we will bring it down into kind of so that star is younger than the universe, as it should be. So that's just one tiny example. But overall, to keep that part short, cosmology is a very young field. It's a very immature field. It's full of imaginative theories. There are also problems that we don't even know the size of the universe. We know the observable cosmos, but we have no idea how big it is. So it's hard to make an overall comprehensive theory about something we only know a part of. And it's been this thing in cosmology for centuries that it kind of fluctuates between being more scientific and concrete. But then you have new discoveries, and then you get all these imaginative theories. And then sometimes those theories who are more attractive just by their kind of, they can just, like the more stunning theories, let's say, could sometimes just be just much more attractive and get more attention. And you're caught in this kind of swirl of different ideas, but it's hard to know. And it's by definition then a field that is not fully matured yet. So coupling this back to the latest book of Stephen Meyer, it's not the best part of the book to bring in the cosmology. If he stays on the DNA enigma, the kind of the first cell and the Cambrian explosion, these are kind of established hard facts areas where you can look into the science and make some reflections for yourself, and kind of the facts speak for themselves. If you bring in cosmology, you kind of drawn into this very different an area with a different nature, and it's in some ways it's weakening the argument to stay on a more firm established grounds as he could have done. But anyways, we are just halfway through the newest book of the Return of the God Hypothesis. So we will then read the rest and then have a more thorough walkthrough of the whole book. And that was the main things we wanted to say about Steve Meyer. But it's, again, hugely recommended. If anyone hasn't read it, just have a look at it and see what you think. And maybe it can spur some new thoughts. One of the very inspiring and positive arguments in his books is that he has a long, long list, kind of pages of suggestions for further research, which is just sparkling new ideas that could be looked upon and kind of dived into by anyone. So that's kind of what we try to do here, is to find the areas of new discovery, new exploration, and just the joy of learning and discovering more and new things. So that is that's the overall thoughts of his books after having read 2.5 of them. We'll also say that Stephen Meyer is a really good storyteller. Like, it's a very captivating presentation of this race to understand the DNA molecule, for example, and all these big questions that are coming up, and also just getting a walkthrough of how one thing is what Darwin suggested in the middle of the 1800s, and then 100 years later, you had several big discoveries with both the molecular parts, kind of the atoms in the cell, and also fossil finds in, for example, British Columbia or in southern China. So, but that goes back again to the second book, which is perhaps maybe the best one to have as a starting point. At least that's how it looks so far. So those are the main thoughts. There's also interesting kind of history of science there, and just a reminder that the theology part was very much present in the birth of the modern science with Kepler and with Newton, which where they're stating in their work that they are trying to find out kind of how the creator made the creation. So this is kind of they put this as a purpose to their research, and it's a good reminder to just to know that that is the case. That is not like modern science didn't cut off everything outside the strict boundaries of rationality. It was conducted within an embedded understanding of theology, like it was much, which was the how they did it in the medieval times, for example. So that's also a good little reminder that there is something a little bit misrepresented with this complete split between science and theology. It depends on the type of theology. That's kind of that's a whole different topic, but there are huge varieties in what kind of theologies, what kind of conceptual or kind of mysterious versions, or how one approaches or thinks or experiences something like the divine. It depends hugely on the theology one kind of is drawn to, and some of them are much more in some ways more compatible with science than others perhaps, and but this is a whole different topic, because then you will stumble like done so many times earlier in history, and those 500-600 years ago, you will stumble into this debate that the institutions that are representing theology are sometimes against science, but that is not because the theology is it. So anyways, we'll stop this one here. Hope this was interesting and maybe some inspiration to look at Stephen Meyer's books and read it. And if you have any thoughts, please write to us at scienceideas@gmx.com. So scienceideas@gmx.com. And with that, we're going to do more research and come back with another episode and sum up all of Stephen Meyer's work shortly. So with that, hope you're having a great day. Maybe it's nice weather and good cup of coffee. And thanks so much for listening. And see you again in the next episode.
It's not too late to make someone's holiday season a special one. Start now as an Amazon Delivery Station warehouse associate to earn some extra money for the holidays. You'd help bring joy to thousands near you by preparing packages and loading them up for their final delivery. With night and early morning shifts available through the new year, you'd also have the flexibility to spend time with your loved ones. To start as a Delivery Station associate, go to amazon.com/holidaywork. Amazon is a proud equal opportunity employer.
Welcome to It Takes Energy, presented by Energy Transfer, where we talk all things oil and natural gas. Oil and gas drive our economy, ensure our country's security, and open pathways to brighter futures. When it comes to meeting the world's energy needs, more is better. What we mean is our world needs a wide range of energy sources to meet our increasing needs.
Just wind or solar won't get us there, as the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. With our growing population and the increasing use of energy-demanding technologies like AI, reliability is key. And the reliability of natural gas is unmatched by wind and solar. That doesn't mean we all can't work together, but natural gas is vital to ensuring we meet our energy needs. Look around, and you'll see the essential role oil and gas plays in our lives. Our world needs oil and gas, and people rely on us to deliver it. To learn more, visit energytransfer.com. Welcome to It Takes Energy, presented by Energy Transfer, where we talk all things oil and natural gas. Oil and gas drive our economy, ensure our country's security, and open pathways to brighter futures. What do you know about oil and natural gas? You likely associate them with running your car or heating your home. But these two natural resources fuel so much more than that. More than 6,000 consumer products that we rely on every day are made using oil and gas. Before you even step out the door in the morning, you've already used more products made possible because of oil and gas than you realize. From the toothpaste you brush your teeth with, the soap you washed your face with, and the sheets you slept on. Not to mention your makeup, contact lenses, clothes, and shoes. Oil and gas are vital parts of all these products and so many more. Look around, and you'll see the essential role oil and gas plays in our lives. Our world needs oil and gas, and people rely on us to deliver it. To learn more, visit energytransfer.com.